from the traditional, ancestral, and unceded territory of the Musqueam people here on UBC's Point Grey campus. This is 24 Hours of Student Power. This is a really wonderful day that we have every year where we showcase student achievement on campus because there's a lot of...
It is Friday, the 27th of March, 2020, World Theater Day. And this is Dave Radio with Radio Dave on the radio. We're broadcasting live on CITR 101.9 FM and streaming on the World Wide Web at CITR.ca from an undisclosed location somewhere on the unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh people. It's week two of the big shutdown, thanks to the Mexican beer virus. We are homebound and doing our best to stay clean and keep safe. I'm recording this on my phone in my spare room. This week we present part two of At Home and Overseas, a radio dramatization we did for Remembrance Day in 2015. It's based on the book Six War Years by Barry Broadfoot. Where's my voice? There we go. An oral history of Canada and Canadians during the years 1939 to 1945. I do not have a sore throat. It's fine. It's just a little early morning froggy thing. Now, we chose to play this this particular program during this time after a conversation with a friend of mine, and he remarked on how this is the first worldwide crisis we've had to deal with as a society since the 1940s, when we all had to put our normal lives on hold and come together to support the war effort. That being said, I thought, let's play what it was like to actually do that back during the time of World War II. Now, next week, we're going to rebroadcast some stuff from our friend Chris King that he recorded from his podcast From the Pit, including a great interview, an exit interview he did with Bill Millard when he left the Arts Club last year. Now, if you want to keep up with what's going on in theater around town and around the world, you can check out Colin Thomas's newsletter, Fresh Sheet. Colin is doing a great job of reporting many of the brilliant ways artists are creating and releasing their work during this time of self-isolation and social distance. And on a side note, who's going to be the first to call their band Social Distance? Just wait for Shindig, you'll see. Now, you can find Fresh Sheet by going to .ca, colinthomas.ca, and clicking on the pop-up. It's free and definitely worth it. So with that being said, let's carry on now with part two of At Home and Overseas.
At Home and Overseas. A dramatization of the book Six War Years, 1939 to 1945, by Barry Broadfoot. Adapted for radio by Jason Logan and produced with the kind permission of the Broadfoot Estate. In the early 1970s, Vancouver journalist Barry Broadfoot gathered ordinary Canadian men and women to relate their first-hand experiences in the global conflict against fascism known as the Second World War. Broadfoot invited scores of veterans and others who supported their country as civilian war workers and family members to give their subjective impression of a period when Canada became a major combatant and eventually a member of the United Nations, strongly motivated to preserve world peace. These eyewitness accounts expose the tragic cost of war and retell the personal stories, filled with laughter and tears, of those who fought the battles, raised the children, and built the framework for peace. We present it to you with the wish that we may someday achieve a lasting peace for all humanity.
Thing about the whole evacuation of Japanese from Western Canada, it wasn't just war. It was part economic. They used the war as an excuse. For example, the other fishermen were more than happy to see the Japanese go, and so were the politicians. Whoever cried, "Out with the Japs," they got the vote. And so there was no holding back saying the Japanese were good fishermen, and we got to keep them here because fish is good and we need food for the war effort. There was none of that. Get them out of here. And of course, it was the white fishermen who got the Japanese boats and the gear and houses. In the Fraser Valley, I would say the majority of the other farmers were more than pleased to see the Japanese go, so they could pick up their farms afterwards. This is what happened, and this is something that's not said very often.
They took my land away. 200 acres in one parcel, and south of that piece, they took another 67 acres, and there was nothing you could do in the law courts. They just came and said that within 30 days or 45 days or something, my land would be, as they put it, vested with the crown, which meant they had expropriated it. And for what? Well, maneuvers would be the best way to put it. They wanted to make their battle training areas bigger. I went to my lawyer, he went to Ottawa, not all that far away, and they said I could have my land back within 3 years after the war. The price I got was poor, and it wasn't the best land. But seeing there was a war on, we got off it, because we had to anyway. And we went to Niagara Falls in London, and worked in war plants there. To make a long story short, do you know what heavy tanks and other war machinery will do to a land? It's called compacting. It presses the soil down so hard that it's like concrete. Mind you, it looks the same, but try and plant something on it and get a decent crop. It won't drain, and it won't grow. It will hardly grow forage. Getting $18 an acre, which is, I think, what I got for land which had been in my family for more than 100 years, well, I just think those fellas in Ottawa had a pretty high-handed way of doing things during the war. Not that I was against the war, certainly not. Two of my boys were in it. My brother's boy was killed in a bomber, so we paid our share. But they also ruined my land.
I'll never smile again until I smile at you. I'll never laugh again. What good would it do? For tears would fill my eyes. My heart would realize that our romance is through. I'll never love again. I'm so in love with you. I'll never thrill again to somebody new. Within my heart, I know I will never start to smile again until I smile at you.
I'll never smile again, darling, unless I smile at you. I'll never laugh again. What good would that do? For tears would fill my eyes. My heart would realize that our romance, honey child, it's true.
I'll never love again. I'm so in love with you. I'll never thrill again to somebody new. Within
I know I will never start to smile again until I smile at you.
I think we started deliveries at 4 p.m., and most or many of our telegrams would be killed in action, wounded, or missing in action. As I remember, there were a lot of missing in action, because this was fairly early in the war, and most of the guys getting it were in bombers and fighters, you know, the RCAF and the RAF. We'd get our sheaf of telegrams, you see. They had to be delivered at night, because there would usually be somebody home. Maybe out of 30 telegrams, five might be casualties. Sometimes as many as 8 or 10, but that was pretty high. Sometimes if we weren't sure, we could sneak open the edge of the slick down envelope, and if we saw it was a casualty telegram, then we'd go next door and get a woman there to come with us. Not to bolster up our courage, this was old hat with us, but when a woman just finds out her husband has been shot down and killed, she shouldn't be left alone. I always remember those telegrams. They'd start out with something like this. The Department of National Defense regret. Well, that's all we needed to know. Zoom. Next door and get a neighbor. I always wondered why it shouldn't be the word regrets instead of regret. Isn't regrets better grammar? I guess we were such a callous bunch of young buggers we didn't really think we were smashing some woman's life to bits. We were interested only because a word didn't sound right. If neighbors saw a telegraph boy going up to a house, they'd usually know. Not all that many people had phones then, the Depression being what it was. But there were two mails a day and one on Saturday. And sometimes you'd be in a house, and before you'd left, there'd be a couple of neighbor women heading for the house. This would be in the slums, the poorer districts, where people looked after each other better, not the richer parts, the poorer ones. I always hung around a couple of minutes just to see if they were all right. I'd always ask if there was something I could do. A few times I made tea for women, or I'd run to the nearest phone and call the husband or the daughter or something. I think it must have been the telegraph company that told us not to leave them alone. Jesus Christ, when I think of it, what a rotten way to do things. Sending a young punk of a kid on a bike riding down a street so everybody can see him and everybody wondering, is he stopping here or where will he stop? But you got to remember that later on, there were thousands and thousands and thousands of those things delivered. My own mother got one when I got captured. She said it wasn't so bad. I said, what do you mean it wasn't so bad? Well, she said she didn't mean it that way, but by that time, and this was in August of 44, the sight of the telegraph boy was a pretty common sight, with his black bag and his sheaf of yellow telegrams. And after all, the Carpenter kids and the Melnick kid and the Hudson kid, all within a stone's throw. They'd all got it by then, and they were just around the block. Remember when Lauren Green, the guy who became Pa Cartwright on Bonanza? He was on the 9 o'clock news, and he was called the voice of doom. That big voice giving us the war news every night, and a lot of it was doom. Well, I guess us kids, 16 or 17-year-olds, kids on our rallies and CCMs, we were the riders of doom, although I never thought about it that way. But I'll bet you a lot of women and men who got those telegrams thought of it that way. I guess I was taking part in just about the toughest job of war work and didn't even know about it. Yes, yes, I guess so. Riders of doom.
Carry on, Canada. The inexorable march of the days brings this country near the close of the second year of war. A transformed Canada, many of her men and women clad in uniform, all her people growing more and more conscious of the dangers to this continent of Nazi victory in Europe, faces the unknown future with courage in her heart and increasing understanding in her mind. More and more definitely, the attention of the Canadian people is drawn to the true peril in which they stand. And more definitely, burns the flame of our determination to face those dangers and to bear a noble part in bringing them to naught. Serious of purpose, strong in resolution, Canada carries on.
All pull together through the stormy weather. Carry on, carry on, carry on.
keep on trying, keep the old flag flying, carry on, carry on, carry on. The sun is shining above the cloudy sky, a silver lining will greet you by and by. So all go together through the stormy weather, carry on, carry on, carry on, carry on.
Actually hear the V1s coming overhead. Their primitive jet engine pulsed away until it had gone a predetermined distance when a ton of high explosives plunged into the target below. We call them buzz bombs or doodle bugs, but the V2 rockets were more like today's guided missiles. They came down out of the stratosphere faster than sound without warning. That's what made them an unprecedented weapon of such terror. Just imagine knowing that at any time, day or night, you could be wiped off the map or maimed forever by a deadly rocket you never heard coming. That's terror in my books. I was based in London during the war. There was a little Cockney secretary in the office I was kind of fond of. One morning in 1944, she called to say she couldn't come in that day. Why not? Our house was destroyed last night. Oh, sorry, my dear. Look after your mom until she gets settled again. Can't. Oh, why? Because she was killed by the bomb. Oh. Sorry. See what I mean? Still, the Brits held out until Germany surrendered, but I'll tell you this. If the Blitz attacks had gone on another few months, it's very likely London would have been finished.
My daughter is in women's liberation. When I was just about her age, there was nothing like that. There'd been a lot of talk about emancipation, you know, years before, but that was women getting the vote, wasn't it? But no women's liberation. Looking back on it, we had a pretty poor time of it. That's what the war did, though. Got thousands, oh my goodness, tens of thousands of women and girls out of the home. In 1936, I came to Winnipeg from Dauphin, just out of high school. There were three things you could do. You could work as a waitress and have some fry cook pawing you. I know, I tried that for 2 weeks. You could work at Eaton's department store mail order for $11 to $12 a week and walk out of there half dead every night to a lonely room somewhere. I had friends who did that, and that was enough for me. Or you could go work for a family. Of course, that meant that you were cook, bottle washer, ran errands, washed floors, and you were the babysitter, but you know, back home in Dauphin, that's what I was doing anyway. I got in through a friend with a nice family named Gilbert, in a nice house, and I had a room in the basement, a bathroom with shower, and I got Thursday afternoons and Sunday afternoons off after the noon dinner. The pay was only $14 a month, but all in all, that wasn't bad. I was probably better off than those poor girls at Eaton's or some insurance company office because my bed and food was paid for. And that went on until 1940. In 1940, there were war plants starting up, and I went to Toronto because there was an airman stationed at Trenton that I was gaga about. But that didn't work out. But it sure got me out of Winnipeg, and I've never been back except passing through. It was good to be there when I was there, but when my girlfriend and me landed in Toronto, well, you could say we were in a different world. Toronto was a big city, and Winnipeg was just a widening of the road on the prairies. In the radio plant we both worked at, there were hundreds of women. All the bosses were men, but we expected that. Today they'd be demanding women bosses, but not then. Hundreds of women from all over Canada. I've stood at the same workbench with women who had hired girls just like me as domestics. You know, at $5 a week. And now they were complaining they couldn't get maids of their own to work 14 hours a day, cooking and washing and doing their dirty work because they'd all gone into war plants at $25 or $30 a week for a nine-hour day. Oh, you'd have thought we were all traitors. I asked one why she was working in a plant, and she said that her husband was an officer in the Air Force overseas, and she just didn't have much to do. So she was working in the plant, next to domestics like me. Funny. I guess you'd call me a stepper. That's a person who steps out. You never hear it now. Means a girl who likes a good time, likes to go out dancing and partying a lot, and not with one fellow, but with lots of fellas. Well, I sure stepped out in Toronto. I learned what this old world is all about, and I had a good time during the war, and I made good money, and because I always had dates, I saved some money after what I had spent for clothing and lipstick and stockings when I could get them, and our pay kept getting better and better. The war killed all the servant business, being a maid, and I think it did a lot to finish off the idea that a woman's place is in the home. My God, there were tens of thousands of us living a life, the kind of life that we'd never known before. Money and good times and lots of men, and more than anything, I guess you could say, freedom. Yes. I'll admit some just couldn't handle the freedom, but they were just a few. Husbands and boyfriends came back from the war and found their wives and girlfriends just weren't prepared to start washing dishes again. Must have been quite a shock. But some women had ferried Air Force bombers to Britain, and others drove ambulances and worked in canteens serving the troops, or in war plants handling very expensive tools, working on equipment, planes, instrument panels and things. And the companies found they could do all this better than men. It's no lie.
I remember. I was just a kid. We'd lost the farm to taxes long ago and just stayed on it because Dad could get a little work with the government, and he fiddled in an orchestra Saturday nights. I think he got a dollar and a half for that. In 1940, everything else seemed to be getting better in Canada, except on the farms in Saskatchewan. So Dad and Mom took us to Regina, and I went to school there. And then Selma, my sister, finished school and went to work in a meatpacking plant. She was up to her waist in animal guts half the time, she said. It was very hard work. You got paid by the month then, and Selma figured her paycheck would be about $65 or so, and Mom was looking forward to it. We were living in a little house darn near out on the prairie, and it was no fun. But Mom figured she could brighten things up a bit with Selma's first pay. Yellow curtains and things. Selma's late coming home that Saturday, and when she comes, in she waltzes, full of beans. And she has this box, and out of it comes a coat. A muskrat fur coat, which was pretty big stuff in those days. It was a nice coat. Mother said, very quietly, "What's that?" Selma said, "What's it look like?" "It's a muskrat coat, and it fits me just right. And here's the hat and gloves to go with it." And she takes out two bags and shows us, brown gloves and a little hat with some stuff on top of it. Mother said, "Where's your paycheck?" Selma said, "Spent, all spent, on this and this and my wonderful coat." I'd say our family fell apart right at that moment. Mother picked up her wicker sewing basket and wanged Selma right across the face with it and cut loose. "I think you little bitch," was one of her kinder expressions. She's screaming and Selma's yelling and hugging the coat to her and Mom is trying to grab it and it's just one awful mess. What's worse than a family fight? It was easy to see Mom's side. 6 years out on the Saskatchewan prairie, drought years, dry as a bone by June. So we ate free pork and whitefish, which the government gave away by the ton, and potatoes and turnips until they're coming out our ears. And when we get things turned around and seeming to go right, her daughter spends her paycheck, puts it on her back. And at that, Mom couldn't even afford a sweater. She was the Goodwill store's best customer. Of course, I could see Selma's point, too. Girls that age are pretty damned unreasonable. But she must have waded through a lot of guts to earn that money. Figured every penny was hers. It ended up with Mom getting hold of the coat, Selma storming out of the house, and Mom taking the coat back to the tailor downtown on Monday. He told her she could have $40 for it. After all, he says, it's a secondhand garment. Selma quits her job, goes to stay with a girlfriend, and the next week, after raising a bit of hell around town, she joins the Army, the Women's Army Corps. And, my friend, that was the last we saw of her. Every year, Mom would get a Christmas card. About every third year, it would say there was a new kid, but that's all. She's out in Vancouver somewhere, married again, probably doing very well. And Mom is dead.
So Buddy and I, we got drunk in Brussels, and somehow we wound up in a fancy brothel that the Germans had set up when they were running things. The girls had gone, but the madam was still there. An old hag, but real interesting. God, she could tell you all about the Germans. So we're drinking her wine, and she says she's still under house arrest unless she's escorted by troops. For some reason, this was the setup. Canadians were like kings after liberating Belgium. We could do no wrong. So we say to this old girl, we're gonna take her to the fanciest nightclub in Brussels. God, is she happy, and off we go. She's got this huge car and a chauffeur. So we go to this nightclub, and it's full of officers. And here I am, a corporal, and my buddy is a sergeant. And we've got this old bag in a 1908 gown with her chauffeur, and he's lugging along a case of the best champagne in all Belgium, 10 years old maybe, and everybody else is drinking raw wine. Whoo! So I dance with the old madam, and about the third time around this tiny floor, I see a colored girl at a table, and she's with two Arabs in those long white burnouses, you know? And I don't know them, but I recognize her. It's Josephine Baker, the famous American jazz singer. So when the music stops, I send a bottle of bubbly over to their table, and about 10 minutes later, I ask her to dance. Me, a bloody corporal, asking Josephine Baker to dance with me. So we dance. Oh, the two guys in Arab clothes? Hell, they were American Negroes, sergeants in some regiment. But there was so much racial discrimination in the American Army that this is the way they had to go. Negroes, no way. Arabs, sure, come on in. So I get back to my table, and there are two American field officers next to us, and high rank. Colonels, I think. And one starts to give me hell for dancing with a Negro. Josephine Baker. To me, she's a great artist. To them, she's shit. So I put up with this crap for a bit, and then I got up, knocked off his hat because the silly bastard was still wearing it inside this nightclub, and I pasted him one, and then another right in the chops. And when his pal got up, I knocked him on his ass too. And by the time the police got there, if they ever did, my pal and me and our madam and her chauffeur were hell and gone away in that big car of hers.
From coast to coast, the Dominion celebrates the long-awaited day of victory in the West. In every town in the Dominion, the strain of over 5 years of war is relaxed momentarily as Canucks pay tribute to their sons who have played such a vital part in winning victory in the West.
I'll never forget VE Day. It was the most vivid thing. We were in stuffy old Victoria. We were just kids. We wore skirts and sweaters and bobby socks. Just kids. The whole place went crazy. You wouldn't believe it. We heard about it and everybody in our school cut classes. Even the teachers cut classes. And it was just kissing and hugging and screaming. Bands and parades and people just going up and down the streets. Just absolutely mad. There was no such thing as time or not knowing somebody. You hugged everybody you met and sang at the top of your lungs. There were sailors and soldiers with bottles of rum and men from the shipyards with cases of beer, and just everybody was drinking everywhere, and fellows climbing lampposts and going through the downtown streets singing and laughing. Nobody was throwing things or breaking anything, and the police just stood by and let people have a good time. And they had the band playing Roll Out the Barrel and other war songs, and this must have gone on for hours, but nobody got tired, not that I know of. And people were singing and shouting as loud as when the first whistles blew until it got dark that night. My girlfriends and me, we were about 13 or 14, and I don't really think we knew there was a war on, except for the blackout curtains, and because we didn't have the kinds of clothes we wanted. And some of our older brothers had gone to the war. But we just went crazy as anybody that day and got kind of hysterical and whooped it up as if we'd just won the war by ourselves.
In a running, when he heard the whistle blow, the postman brought a letter, an airmail from our Joe. It said, "I've come back safely from across the ocean blue." Then Pa took off Pa's apron and he hollered out, "Yahoo!
I'll leave my nation in the safe. I'll leave the nation in the safe.
Each dirty plate will have to wait. Tonight we're going to celebrate.
Leave the dishes in the safe."
Pa started in a jiggin', and he cried, "Ma, shake a leg. I'm going down the cellar, cause there's cider in the keg. The bologna's in the icebox, there's cheese and pickles too. We'll call in all the neighbors, cause tonight's our night. Yahoo!
I'll leave the dishes in the sink. I'll leave the dishes in the sink.
Each dirty plate will have to wait. Tonight we're gonna celebrate.
Leave the dishes in the sink."
And while they all were dancing, the door flew open wide, and everybody stopped, and Sergeant Joey stepped inside. He shouted out, "Engine!" And everybody knew to bother with the dishes was not the thing to do.
I'll leave the dishes in the sink. I'll leave the dishes in the sink.
Each dirty plate will have to wait. Tonight we're gonna celebrate.
Leave the dishes in the sink.
Don't let anyone ever tell you it was all blue sky and sunshine for a guy not in uniform in those years. Sometimes, it was pure hell. Fellows who tried to enlist and been turned down, they got this little pin they could wear. And if people knew what it meant, well, then they were okay. It was a deferment, vital to the war effort. But a classification like that meant that I had no pin. And to a lot of people, it looked like I was running away from the whole thing. Well, like hell I was. I was a master mechanic and stationary engineer, and I worked in this little factory just outside Hamilton. And the family who owned it had wangled a job making parts for bearings for Liberty ships. If the government had given the contract to somebody bigger, they'd probably have been better off. But as it was, we were vital to the war effort. I was 29, and just ripe for a uniform, but there I was, keeping that damn plant going, running back and forth between the machine shop and the boiler room like an Olympic champion. 18 hours in a day and 10 on Sunday was nothing, keeping that plant going. Every time I tell the boss to shove it, he'd give me a raise and run off to the procurement board and get my deferment renewed. I couldn't have joined the army even if I'd wanted to. That didn't help me, though. See, back in 1943, I was 6'1" and a good 195 pounds, none of it fat. But because I could make an engine part on a lathe out of scrap iron I'd find in the back of the shop, I was essential. And I took shit for it. Ask my wife. We couldn't go to a dance. We'd be bumping the floor by Army and Navy types. And the Air Force wasn't as bad. But you'd hear all sorts of cracks like, maybe he's got a wooden leg. Or is that silver plate in his head where they pour the sawdust in? And I guess his old man's got money. And on. Christ. There were 1,000 insults. I heard them all. When we finally stopped going to dances, the wife just couldn't take it anymore. She used to cry about it. You got it on the streets, remarks you heard as you walked by. And I remember once in a streetcar, I was sitting at the back and I felt something tapping the bottom of my foot. And there was a paratrooper kicking me. And when I looked at him, he gave me the up yours sign. Sure, I could have got up and wailed him one. But he had two buddies with him. And if you don't think that's what they're waiting for me to do, then you're wrong. You had to watch yourself. There were thousands of us, I guess. Maybe we should have formed our own organization.
We were prisoners working in a Japanese copper mine. We had a radio in the camp, and the day the emperor told his people they had gone under, we immediately took over the camp. And we ran ourselves. The head of our camp was an American officer, Captain Ziegler from Wichita Falls, Texas, and he just took over. He told the Japanese, you people just stay there, the war's over. Come and we'll show you how we know. And he took out a radio. I still have the earphones, and this radio was put together out of odds and ends, bits and pieces. And it worked beautifully. I worked in the battery shop, and as prisoners, it was rather a dangerous thing to bring out batteries for a radio. I once carried a small wet cell battery under my hat, and I didn't dare stumble or anything because the acid would have run down my head. But it was the only way that we could get them into camp. We became the conquerors, and they became the prisoners, so to speak, even though we were all still in the camp. Within a couple of days, planes off of an aircraft carrier came and asked us to lay out a signal of what we needed, of food, medical supplies, and they started dropping big boxes of stuff. We gained weight quickly, but because we weren't used to the food, a lot of people were sick. The Americans came in a month after the surrender, about September 19th, and they took us and put us on a hospital ship and gave us a shower, a spray, and took all the new clothes they had dropped by plane and just shoveled them overboard and gave us new uniforms. That was funny. Yeah, we decided that when we marched out of that camp, we'd wear our new uniforms. So we wore our old clothes, the ones we'd been in for years, for the whole of that last month. And then when we got aboard the hospital ship, they took away those uniforms. So here they were, throwing away uniforms that had only been worn a few hours. After going 4 years without clothes, it was a shattering experience. Another funny thing happened in Guam, in the hospital. We were put in these Quonset huts, all made up neat with bunks and pajamas, and our boys all got in bed, and they turned out the lights, and then you'd hear thump, and thump, and thump. And the lights went on, and the nurses and orderlies came in, and we were all laying on the floor. Soft beds? We couldn't sleep in them. So after about three times, they just told us to sleep where we liked. The next morning, the Red Cross people came in. There were girls who tried to get us to talk to them, write letters home, and so on. It took us about a day to get used to it. We hadn't seen women for so long, we couldn't talk to them. We didn't even know how to act with them around.
This was east of Cleveland, about the fourth day of our major assault. A tank rumbles up, sent back by the squadron commander, and it stops at our headquarters, and there in the turret with a Canadian lieutenant is a German officer. This was a bit of a surprise. Power Patrol capturing a German officer like this? He was a lieutenant with a regiment from Pomerania, but he wasn't saying anything. Just his name, rank, and serial number. But he was willing to talk to anyone about anything else. Actually, he appeared at first like a good stick in his own way. But then it became clear he was still pretty hopped up on Hitler and Nazism. He'd been a Hitler youth and so on, but really knew nothing about Hitler. A perfect result of Goebbels' propaganda tactics. This chap had also helped turn out others like him because he'd been, so he said, attached to the psychological warfare unit of his own regiment and probably wasn't a combat soldier at all. But he sure knew the lingo. We asked him, didn't he know Germany was finished? And he said yes. The Russians had beaten them in the east, but in 15 or 20 years, there would be a new Germany, ready to go. Didn't give us much credit for kicking the daylights out of their best divisions in Normandy. He said he loved Hitler because he had given Germany the glory it deserved, and efficiency and strength and greatness and so on and so on. And the more he talked, the more he sounded like a vest pocket Hitler. We were bored with it all, and our major, a very, very hard man, had this grim look to him, and finally he said, "Lieutenant, take two good men and walk this man to the edge of the trees and give him a running start. 5 yards, he'll be shot for attempting to escape." He wasn't bluffing. This guy never bluffed. So I took our prisoner by the arm, and as I led him out, he said to our CO, he said, "I expected more from an officer of the Canadian Army. We have always considered you fair and worthy opponents." Something like that. So there I was, stuck. The fellow didn't deserve shooting, and he shouldn't be executed. Not by the rules of war. So I turned back, and old Fishface was giving me the eye, and I said, "Sir, the Geneva Convention? A question, you see." And he put down his pipe very wearily, I thought, and he said, "Yes, you're quite right. Then we'd be playing their game, wouldn't we?" And he said, "Do whatever you do with people like this." So I handed him over to the provost sergeant and told him to deliver him to the rear. When he got in the jeep, the German said, "Thank you, Lieutenant." And I said, "You know, something like, forget it. We've all got to make a living. Something inane." Then he said, "Would you consider, sir, that I was lucky?" And I said, "If you live to be 105 years old, Lieutenant, you'll never be so lucky again." Then he stuck out his hand. What the hell could I do? I shook it.
"Kiss me goodnight, Sergeant Major. Tuck me in my little wooden bed. We all love you, Sergeant Major. When we hear you falling, show a leg. Don't forget to wake me in the morning and bring me round a nice hot cup of tea. Kiss me goodnight, Sergeant Major. Sergeant Major, be a father to me."
It was something of a letdown. I think all of us felt it, and I've talked to English people about it, and they agreed that when it was all over, we found something important and vital was missing from our lives. I guess it was that the war was over, and we all had to go back to the ordinary business of living. The trouble is, or was, that so many of us had never had what I'd call the ordinary business of living. Myself, for instance, I came from a small village in Bruce County, and I took a year of university, and then I joined the Air Force. So all I knew was my father's dairy farm, high school, 1 year at McMaster, and then the Air Force. The only people I knew after 3 years away from home, Coastal Command, and then bombing Germany, all I knew were people from the Air Force and a few English people. I didn't know anybody in Canada, and I didn't know what I wanted, and I certainly didn't know how to earn a living. Once we were sitting around the mess and yakking, and there were a few English girls, officers in the women's division, awfully nice kids. There were some Aussies and a few New Zealanders and a couple of English and Scottish lads because we were kind of a polyglot squadron. And we were talking and one of the girls said, "One thing I do miss, the sound of our engines. You fellas coming home in time for tea?" We all laughed. An Australian chap said, "I'm sorry it's all over. I'll never have so much fun again. Now it's back to the salt mines for me. Bloody dull Melbourne." I'd like to say we were all shocked, but we weren't. We'd had it pretty good to very good, although a lot of our guys had died. Anyway, there were a few seconds while everybody thought about it, and guys were nodding their heads or saying, yeah, and, well, you're right, buddy. And then one of the girls lifted her glass and said, a toast to the war. And the war was what we all drank to.
They say there's a troop ship just leaving Bombay, bound for old Blighty Shore. Heavily laden with time-expired men, bound for the land they adore. There's many an airman just finishing his time, there's many a twerp signing on. You'll get no promotion this side of the ocean, so cheer up, my lads, bless 'em all. Bless 'em all, bless 'em all, the long and the short and the tall. Bless all the sergeants and WO1s, bless all the corporals and their blinking sons, 'cause we're saying goodbye to them all. As back to their billets they crawl. You'll get no promotion this side of the ocean, so cheer up, my lads, bless 'em all. They say if you work hard you'll get better pay. We've heard all that before. Clean up your buttons and polish your boots, scrub out the barrack room floor. There's many a rookie has taken it in, hook, line and sinker and all. You'll get no promotion this side of the ocean, so cheer up, my lads, bless 'em all. Bless 'em all, bless 'em all, the long and the short and the tall. Bless all the sergeants and WO1s, bless all the corporals and their blinking sons, 'cause we're saying goodbye to them all. As back to their billets they crawl. You'll get no promotion this side of the ocean, so cheer up, my lads, bless 'em all. Now they say that the sergeant's a very nice chap. Oh, what a tale to tell. Ask him for leave on a Saturday night, he'll pay you fare home as well. There's many an airman has blighted his life through writing rude words on the wall. You'll get no promotion this side of the ocean, so cheer up, my lads, bless 'em all.
Bless 'em all,
bless 'em all,
bless 'em all,
bless 'em all, the long and the short and the tall. Bless all the sergeants and WO1s, bless all the corporals and their blinking sons, 'cause we're saying goodbye to them all. As back to their billets they crawl. You'll get no promotion this side of the ocean, so cheer up, my lads, bless 'em all. Nobody knows what a twerp you have been, so cheer up, my lads, bless 'em all.
Oh, the war brides. Oh, yes, I remember them. They'd be landed off the boats in Montreal, and the Red Cross Corps would take them to Toronto and then pass them on to Winnipeg and then to Calgary or Edmonton, where we'd meet them and bring them to Vancouver. Some were terrified, but they were a jolly bunch and laughing, and they'd been through a lot of adversity, rationing, bombing, years of war. But as they got closer to Vancouver, some would come up to me and say, "Do you think I'll know him?" And I'd say, "Sure, you'll know him." And she'd say, "But I only knew him for a week or for 6 weeks, and then he was sent home wounded, and that's the last I saw of him. Do you think he'll be in uniform so I'll know him?" I'd have to say, "No, he probably won't be in uniform, but he would know her." That used to cheer them up. And you know, when we arrived, there was always somebody to meet them, and they'd all find their husbands. But the night before, oh, the excitement. Some of them had babies, little children, and there was always one nurse with them, an RN, plus two of us Red Cross Corps for every three cars of girls, and they'd be asking us hundreds of questions, and the night before we got to Vancouver, the porters would bring in big tubs of hot water, and everybody would bathe. They'd do each other's hair, they'd laugh and joke and sing, but you could see that they were terrified, a lot of them. Some were very nervous. There wasn't too much sleeping done that night, I can tell you. And some were led on very badly, you know. Soldiers telling the girls their parents were wealthy, and when they'd tell me where they were going, showing me the addresses, my heart used to sink. The downtown skid road somewhere, and I used to think how terrible the shock was going to be. Some would be anxious before they even got off the train. The size of Canada terrified them. It was so big. The ride was so long. I'd tell them that once they left the prairies, it was like going into another land, a beautiful country, and the mountains and the rivers, the Thompson and the Fraser, those great rivers absolutely fascinated them. Some, of course, were disillusioned once they got with their husbands. There would be no big ranch, but just a shack in the hills somewhere, things like that. These lads had often led the girls on terribly, but they came through it, most of them. Some of them went home, of course. But I don't think I ever saw one girl on the train who wasn't prepared to be a good wife and to give her husband a good life. It's just that for some, things didn't work out at all. But by and large, I think everything worked out pretty well for most war brides.
Moment divine when all the things you are mine.
The devil put on a different face, came to plague the human race. We'll put that old devil back in his place. Sing hallelujah, we'll be singing marching through Berlin. We'll be singing hallelujah, marching through Berlin. When we drive those sons of Satan from their place of sin, we'll be singing hallelujah, marching through Berlin. When we get there, we're gonna see the world has peace and liberty. That's the way it's gonna be, 'cause a man's no good unless he's free.
We'll be singing hallelujah, marching through Berlin.
We'll be singing hallelujah, marching, marching through Berlin.
Boo-hee, 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 flirt, dot, rah-da.
Boys are home again, all over the world, and rain or snow is all that may fall from the skies above. A kiss won't mean goodbye, but hello to love. The ships will sail again all over the world. Then we'll have time for things like wedding rings, and free hearts will sing when the lights go on again.
All in all, when you take everything into the overall plan, think now of every consideration, I guess you could really, really see the enemy lost the last war because they had lousier leaders than we did. If you thought there was unbelievable pig-headed thinking on our side, there must have been even more on the other side. Stands to reason. I don't know who said it, but war is far, far too important to leave to the politicians and the generals. And I still believe that.
When the lights go on again, all over the world, and the the ships will sail again all over the world. Then we'll have time for things like wedding rings.
You have been listening to At Home and Overseas, based on the book Six War Years by Barry Broadfoot, featuring the voices of Adam Abrams, Garth Barrier, Mary Black, Dave Campbell, Caitlin Docking, Bob Fraser, His Majesty King George VI, Lorne Green, Adam Henderson, Julia Henderson, Paul Herbert, Keenan Johnston, William Lyon Mackenzie King, Sebastian Croon, Tarek Leslie, Jason Logan, Ashley O'Connell, Sean Harris Oliver, John Prowse, Nick Rinka, Maureen Rohde, Deborah Sears, Bronwyn Smith, Laura Rose Tansey, John Taylor, Tracy Varju, Rebecca Walters, and Jessica Wright. Produced with the cooperation of the Estate of Barry Broadfoot, the Union of BC Performers, the Student Radio Society of UBC, CITR-FM. This program was adapted for radio by Jason Logan, produced by Dave Campbell, and directed by Jason Logan and Dave Campbell. This is Seth Little speaking.
Listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
Hey, it's Max from Laverne, and you're listening to CITR. Yeah.